Urinary tract infections. Treat, identify, and document. A conversation with Patty Austin. This webinar included a visual PowerPoint presentation. To view a video recording, visit the link in the description of this podcast.
Good afternoon and welcome to our series of webinars focused on bringing you information about COVID-19 related topics. The information in these weekly webinars is geared toward long-term care and skilled nursing facilities. We encourage everyone who's interested to attend. My name is Kathy Caudill. I'm a communications specialist with Quality Insights, and today we'll be discussing how to treat, identify, and document urinary tract infections. And I'd like to introduce our guest today, Patty Austin. Patty is a quality improvement specialist at Quality Insights. She has been working in the skilled nursing arena for the past 29 years, starting her career as a nursing assistant and leaving the front lines as director of nursing. Patty has been with Quality Insights since 2016, and she considers it a privilege to be able to interact with so many different nursing facilities to help create lasting change within their communities. Patty, thanks for joining us again today.
Hi, everybody, and thank you, Kathy. So as we continue to talk about infections that often result in emergency department trips or readmissions, we have been very focused on respiratory illness, especially at this time of the year, as we're moving into flu and pneumonia season, and we're anticipating the return of a greater number of COVID cases. However, we do have an old friend that has long been a culprit in our setting that I'd like to revisit today, our old friend UTI. So the urinary tract is one of the most common sites of healthcare-associated infections. And they actually account for about 20% of infections that are reported by long-term care facilities. And our setting is ripe with risk factors for UTIs, including things like age-related changes, comorbid conditions that result in things like neurogenic bladder. And then there's the instrumentation that is required to manage bladder voiding, along with just so many other things that we'll touch on as we move forward, all lead to our setting being kind of a hotbed for UTIs. So as we begin, I would like to mention something that doesn't really often get very much attention or focus. That something is asymptomatic bacteremia. The rates of asymptomatic bacteremia can actually range from 20 to 50% in our setting. So think about that for just a minute. At any given time, if you tested your entire census, as many as 50% of them might show bacteria in their urine, but display no signs or symptoms of a UTI. The tendency for us to see a positive urine culture and then want to treat it is really strong, but the treatment of asymptomatic bacteremia isn't the best practice, and it can, in fact, lead to some pretty negative outcomes. I mentioned this here at the start of our talk to really highlight how important it is to identify UTIs appropriately to better serve our residents and to prevent unnecessary hospital trips. Only allow ourselves to rely on urine testing for UTIs to become kind of our first line of defense against everything from a daughter saying, "Mom doesn't seem herself today. I think she has another UTI," or a nurse aide saying, "Mr. Jones was confused at dinner last night," or all of a sudden, "Mrs. Smith is incontinent." When we use those as the impetus to collect a urine sample, we risk overlooking the true cause of the change in condition, as well as potentially starting a treatment course that may not be appropriate. So symptomatic UTI rates are lower than that 20 to 50%, but they still result in a pretty significant portion of infections in our residents and result in high antibiotic use, as well as hospitalizations and emergency room trips. Then, of course, we can't really get started without mentioning catheter use. Though the prevalence of indwelling catheters is lower in SNFs than it is in the acute care setting, and we have become pretty darn good at removing them on admission, catheter-associated UTIs can lead to complications as serious as septic shock, so they still remain on our radar. Okay, so now we've set the stage for kind of understanding the importance of urinary tract infection identification. Let's see what else we have on deck. When we're talking about UTIs, we can really be referencing one of two things, either a bladder infection or a kidney infection. For our purposes today, we are going to quickly look at the differences in symptoms, but as we move deeper into our talk, we're going to kind of be more generalized, and the concepts that we will talk about will apply to both bladder and kidney infections. So bladder infections are the most common area of infection in the urinary tract. And for that reason, the term UTI and bladder infection are often used interchangeably. Sometimes though, when bladder infections are left untreated, they move higher into the urinary tract and infect the kidneys. And then they're classified as the far more serious kidney infection. Another fairly common cause of kidney infections, aside from untreated bladder infections, are kidney stones. Kidney stones can actually trap urine inside the bladder, and that kind of forms a breeding ground for bacteria. And once the kidneys are involved, more serious complications come into play, things like sepsis and, again, even septic shock. The symptoms of bladder and kidney infections do differ. Sometimes nurses can combine the two symptom sets, and doing this can confuse the matter just a little bit. Flank pain is often thought of as kind of a cardinal sign of a UTI, when really a bladder infection will seldom have actual flank pain. It's more likely that a bladder infection will have pressure in that lower abdomen. Confusing those two sets can kind of hinder our ability to catch a UTI in its early stages and prevent the need for an extended course of antibiotics and potentially even an IV. By the time flank pain is present, we might have moved from that simple bladder infection into the more serious kidney infection. So we want to try to really separate those two symptom sets in our minds. But really our goal is early identification and appropriate diagnoses. It's kind of one of those areas in which we're walking a tightrope. And if you slip off of one side of the tightrope, you're going to end up treating asymptomatic bacteremia when most likely we should not. And that might lead to a decline in the quality of life as we introduce the possibility of things like MDROs. Or we could fall off the other side of the tightrope and miss that early diagnosis and treatment of a bladder infection that then results in a kidney infection, again, leading to decreased quality of life, longer and stronger antibiotics, and possibly hospitalization. Of course, testing and treatment decisions are at the discretion of the attending physician, but we do have to remember that often those physicians are basing their decisions on our assessments and recommendations. And one thing that can help us in the early identification process is understanding those people that are naturally at a higher risk. Some things to consider when you're looking at a risk for UTIs is anyone that's had a UTI in the past is indeed at higher risk for another moving forward. Women are more prone to UTIs than men due to anatomy. It's easier for bacteria to travel through the shorter urethra in a woman than it is for a man. Diabetics are more prone to UTIs, first due to their weakened immune system, but then even more so if they are uncontrolled diabetics and have sugar spilling over into the urine, that sugar is just feeding bacteria and increasing the risk of a UTI. And then how many of our residents don't completely empty their bladder? And when that urine remains in the bladder, it too becomes a breeding ground for bacteria. Any type of obstruction to the flow of urine, things like kidney stones or enlarged prostates, increases risk of UTIs. Not drinking enough water. We know that our population is at risk for dehydration and that water is continually a focus. That water also helps flush the bladder and prevent UTIs. And even things like genetics play a role. The size and shape of the urinary tract makes some people naturally more prone to infection. So what can we do to help our prevention efforts? Maybe the biggest thing we can do is to empower our staff. The path to empowerment often begins with education, right? So be sure that your frontline staff understands the urinary system and what they can do to protect it, as well as how to communicate with others when they do suspect an issue is at play. We really have some fantastic communication techniques that can really move our ability to transmit messages in an effective way to the next level. People like nursing assistants, dietary aides, housekeepers, and of course, even family members are those who know our residents the best. They know them better than the infection control nurse or the supervisor, or in many, many, many cases, even the physician. So it's our responsibility to give those people the voice that they need to communicate changes with the people who can then take steps to assess and act on the changes when needed. One great way to do that is to utilize a combination of the stop and watch tool and the CUSP process, making those methods of communications the expectation is going to serve to empower those who have the insight into our residents to really make an impact. So let's quickly look at some of the little things that we should be doing every day that can help to prevent UTIs. First, we all know the importance of staying hydrated. 6 glasses of water a day can feel like a whole lot for some of our residents, and it is for some of our residents. 6 glasses of water does not mean 6 med cups of water. The recommended non-caffeinated fluid intake for a healthy senior is 64 ounces a day. That's a lot. That does, however, need to be balanced by other diagnoses, things like CHF, that might conversely limit water intake. As always, when questions arise as it relates to fluid intake, consult the attending physician. I really like on this particular slide the tip for dementia residents of using a brightly colored cup to encourage that water intake. We know that our residents are prone to dehydration, and even more so our dementia population. Sometimes a brightly colored cup or even a familiar glass from home can be helpful for some of those residents that are particularly, I guess, resistant to getting those fluid ounces in. We monitor fluid intake pretty routinely, right? It's one of the expectations, we have to do it. However, sometimes our accuracy is not what we would expect it to be. Flashcards that include the ounces that are contained and then converted into cc's, depending on which system you use, that are contained in each drinking vessel that is common in your facility, can help to lend some consistency to the documentation that you're getting. Even competencies related to fluid documentation can be useful. Additionally, you might want to consider if your definitions of the quality of urine is standard within the facility. Things like the term tea-colored urine, we use that term all the time, but is the meaning of the term tea-colored consistent between your staff members? For our continent residents, frequent trips to the bathroom are important. Scheduled toileting can help, but residents should understand that if they have to void, they shouldn't wait and let that breeding ground grow for someone to come on their scheduled time. They should request assistance and go when that urge is present. Again, for those with dementia or visual impairment, I really like the tip of using a different colored toilet seat. It can be very helpful. The different colored toilet seat, it's interesting that not only can it be a visual indicator of, yes, this is where we perform this specific act, but as depth perception is impacted by things like dementia, or even for those non-dementia residents, what we want to do is avoid having the bathroom become a place of fear or somewhere that a resident is hesitant to frequent. And if you think about it, if you feel like you're having to sit down 3 feet until you make contact with that toilet seat, you're going to be a little bit fearful if somebody lowers you to that level. So the brighter color can help to minimize that fear factors. Constipation. Now that's something we routinely avoid, but we seldom give consideration to its impact on our ability to empty the bladder. So when you're constipated, it restricts urine flow. Water intake then is going to serve kind of double duty in helping to prevent constipation and help to flush the bladder and prevent UTIs, kind of a 2-for-the-price-of-1 deal. Okay, so this slide. For me as an old nursing assistant, this is a big one. It can be a natural tendency for us to want to use talcum powder or baby powder after incontinent care. Smells good. Folks of a certain age are used to using that for our children. And in many ways, it just feels like the right thing to do. If it's moist, powder's going to help dry it. And although there are medicated powders that this does not apply to, talcum or perfume powders are no longer recommended for use during incontinence care. The important thing is to provide incontinent care promptly. Catheters do create a natural portal of entry for bacteria, and people using urinary catheters are indeed at higher risk for UTIs. Your infection control program should absolutely contain education and competencies on catheter care. So we've talked about risk factors and prevention. Now let's dive into how we actually determine if symptoms are classified as UTI. First thing we're going to look at is the symptomatic UTI when a catheter is in use, or CAUTI. Remember that this would be the case if the resident has a catheter now or the catheter has been removed in the 2 days prior to symptom onset. The forms on the screen right now are absolutely great. They're easy to use and they come right from the NHSN website. They really do make it so extremely simple. And because they do make it so easy to navigate your way through, I am not going to go through the criteria for each UTI type. But you can see it's as simple as checking the boxes, making sure that you have one box checked in each category, and then you'll know whether or not you have the criteria met. So, next up, we have symptomatic UTIs for those without a urinary catheter. In my opinion, this is probably the most complex of the examples because there are three different sets of criteria to move through. So you have to meet the requirements for each of the three areas. But again, the form makes it extremely easy to navigate. And last, we do have asymptomatic bacteremia. Please note that without a positive blood culture to coincide with a positive urine culture, and the organisms have to match in both of those cultures, you cannot claim asymptomatic bacteremia. Again, form walks you right on through it. And that takes us right into MDS coding. So, how does what we just talked about and meeting those criteria apply to the MDS? I do have our MDS guru on the phone with us here today, and that is Deb Wright. So if I leave anything out or you have any MDS related questions, she is here to jump in and help us both out. We know that diagnoses are coded in section I of the MDS, and UTI is actually item I-2300. The first thing of note is that UTI look-back period is different than the look-back period of other active diagnoses. For UTIs, it's 30 days, not a 7-day look-back. If the resident is newly admitted, that look back scan is also going to include the hospital record if the documented diagnosis is again within 30 days of the MDS ARD date. In order to take credit on the MDS for a UTI, two things have to be present. First, you have to have the documentation that it was determined that the resident had a UTI using evidence-based criteria like NHSN or McGreer's. And that has to have been within the past 30 days. The second thing you need is you have to have a documented physician diagnosis within the last 30 days. That diagnosis can be written by the physician, a nurse practitioner, or a PA. If the diagnosis was made prior to admission or readmission, you don't actually have to evaluate the evidence-based criteria that was used. You don't have to ask for proof of them meeting the McGreer's criteria, for example. The physician's diagnosis alone is acceptable. And that information most likely will be found right in the hospital transfer summary or in the other paperwork that you receive from the hospital. Simply put, within 30 days of the ARD date, you have to have evidence-based criteria and a physician's diagnosis of a UTI to code section I-2300 for a UTI. And then what happens to it? You put it into the MDS and it goes right on over to the quality measures. The information that we put into I-2300 goes directly to our QM report in the long stay quality measure, percentage of residents with urinary tract infections. And it's a really, really simple measure. We're looking at long stay residents, and that means that we're only counting those residents that have been in the facility for our 101 days or more. The numerator is simply those who were coded yes for a UTI in the past 30 days in I-2300. And the denominator is all long-stay residents with a target assessment, with the exception of any target assessment that is an admission or a PPS 5-day. And of course, you're going to be excluded if I-2300 is missing. So really super simple measure, but that is kind of how we go from capturing on McGreer's or MHSN criteria, documenting into the MDS, to it showing up on your QM report. We know what we're looking for now, right? And we know who's at risk. We know how we're documenting. We know what we're doing to prevent UTIs when we're able to. Now let's take a look at what we can do to make sure that when we do have a UTI, we're doing what we can to prevent avoidable hospitalizations. In large part, that comes down to good communication. We need strong, open lines of communication between our frontline staff and our clinical leaders to ensure that we're catching those potential signs and symptoms early. We need to clearly communicate with our teams the importance of preventative measures that we discussed earlier. And we need to hear their voices when feedback is given to what our expectations are. Remember, communication is not a one-way street. Communication does go both ways. It requires a good sender and a good receiver. So when we're talking with our residents and family members, we need to help them to understand those preventative measures as well and the role that they play in avoiding a urinary tract infection. And that goes hand in hand with helping them to see the danger in what may seem like such a small thing to them. At times, people can tend to think, oh, a UTI, give me some cranberry juice, I'm gonna be fine, just a couple of days of antibiotics, because UTIs at 30 aren't quite what they are at 73. So the risk factor increases with our population, and it's our responsibility to help them to understand the impact of a UTI and the impact that UTI can have on a loved one as well for those family members. Additionally, it's important for them to understand that a bit of confusion does not automatically equate to grabbing a urine sample. And that while, yes, we absolutely need to know that information and we value their input in telling us of those small, subtle changes in condition, that might not mean the automatic jump to urine testing. Explaining asymptomatic bacteremia might help with that. Probably what is going to help even more so than that, or in conjunction with that, is conveying that you hear their concern and you understand their concern, and that you're going to monitor the situation and let the physician know. But that jumping to that urine sample and starting an antibiotic may in fact do more harm than good. Which leads us right into staff to physician communication. Good assessment data is needed by the doctor so that they can make good decisions when they're developing their treatment plan. We are there to provide guidance in that process via our assessments. Using the SBAR technique can really help to standardize your processes and help the physicians get the clear, concise information that they need. There's actually a UTI SBAR that can be used specifically when you believe that you've identified an SBAR or want to rule out identified an SBAR, identified a UTI, or want to rule out a UTI. It's a great tool to use. And then maybe most important is communicating your capabilities to outside providers so that they are aware of what you're capable of treating within the facility. For example, the need for IV antibiotics would most likely not be the cause for an admission to the hospital. And sometimes we see that happening. Communicating with the critical care providers will help ensure that when it's appropriate, your residents do come back to you.
Patty, thank you again for joining us, and we hope that all of you can join us again next week.
If you would like to contact Patty Austin, you can reach her at paustin@qualityinsights.org. You can check out our other interviews at qualityinsights.org/QIN/multimedia.